funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What mark have HIV and AIDS left on the arts community in North Texas, and how has the impact of the virus changed over more than three decades of history? 2 years ago, Titus Executive Director Charles Santos wanted to commemorate the 30th anniversary of the identification of the virus and pay tribute to the many brilliant lives it has ended too early. The result was an unprecedented collaborative effort by numerous area arts organizations and their champions, which came together for a one-night-only, all-volunteer performance to raise money for local AIDS service organizations. 2 years later, Santos has once again united creative partners from a dozen arts organizations, which next Monday will present A Gathering 2013 at the AT&T Performing Arts Center. Charles Santos joins us to talk about the event along with Lily Weiss, who is Dance Cluster Coordinator at Booker T. Washington High School for the Performing and Visual Arts and will be taking part in Monday's program. Charles and Lily, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
So, Charles, talk about how the original gathering came together and what made it so, it sounds like, more extraordinary than anyone at the time could have imagined.
That's true. It actually came about in my history when I was in Austin before I went to New York. I had produced the Austin Festival of Dance, which was a big dance festival AIDS benefit for AIDS Services of Austin. I used to be on their board. And in my fourth year of it, it ran for 10 years. I moved to New York. And so when I was in New York, I was running back and forth to Texas to produce this thing in Austin. And we had moved it from just being a series of dance performances to having AIDS facts and things that were read in between. And it was a remarkable event. And Lily was a big part of that also.
I've actually been a part of his Austin events and certainly the planning of this incredible event, which was 2 years ago.
Yeah. This one, I was at a dinner party with Chris Heinbaugh, who is the VP of External Affairs for the Center. And this was the summer before we did the first gathering. And we were talking about projects that we wanted to do. And I had talked about the festival and the 30th anniversary of the AIDS pandemic and that I would love to take the festival to the sort of next level, write a complete book where everything was created specifically for the show as opposed to selecting works from existing works from companies. Mm-hmm. And he came into my office the next day and said, you have to do it, and the center will back you up on this. And so we did it in 2 months, 2.5 months, the first one. It was the hardest I've ever worked on anything. And I expected – we had this one meeting with all the 11 directors the first time around a table, and I told my assistant, it's either going to be just this horrible catfight or a glorious meeting. And it was fantastic. And I just said, you know, here are the pieces. I selected all this music, and I said, you know, to Ben Stevenson, I need you to choreograph either this piece or this piece. And he said, well, I'll take this one. Then Bridget Moore said, well, I'll take that one. And Bruce Wood said, I'll take this one. And then we just started, you know, the work. And it was an extraordinary event. We had readings from different plays that Joel Farrell had put together from the Dallas Theater Center, and Chris had done all the writing that was sort of the thread that marked all the historical points and facts that we wanted to do. And it was a magical, magical night. The proudest thing I've ever done.
It was educational as well. The event, in between pieces, there were facts that were read, which were astonishing. The fact that this many artists came together in such a short amount of time tells you what a collaborative process can truly be. And no one pitched a fit. Everyone was so willing to stop what they were doing and come together, whether it was for rehearsals or planning, whatever the case was.
And it was rehearsed in 100 different pieces. So mm-hmm. It only came together the night before.
I mean, did you get any sleep that night?
Oh, no, gosh, no. it was a really long rehearsal because mm-hmm. We were building everything from the beginning, cues, stage blocking, working out, you know, mic transfers because there were so many people. And we finished, I think, at about 10:30 or 11. And then my production coordinator, Amarante, and Leslie Allen and I, we all went to the Sheraton until about 3 in the morning, sitting in the restaurant. Working out all the tech notes that had to be done. There was no way to put, you know, you couldn't put it off because the show was the next day.
And it was over 200 artists, right?
Yeah, it was. Well, we were about 175 for the first year. This year was It's the same concept, but we wanted – and one of the things that we did the first year that was very important, we all have a lot of star connections. And so we made a conscious decision to focus on local talent, mm-hmm. that this was a Dallas cultural community's response to HIV/AIDS. So we only used local talent.
So you weren't like calling in headliners from LA or New York?
No, and we started out that way. Mm-hmm. We were going to bring in a star moderator, and but then it becomes about the stars, and we didn't want it to be that way. This year, we did something very special, which was we're not marking an anniversary year of any kind, you know, that's of significance. But it is, you know, AIDS has sort of fallen out of favor. People don't really want to talk about it much anymore, and it's still a significant problem. Mm-hmm. So we had a conversation at my house for 2.5 hours. 25 artists came over and community leaders from 23 to 75 years of age. And, you know, we drank a lot and we ate a lot, and we set up a recorder and said, listen, we just want to talk about everyone's different experiences, thoughts, families, loss, faith, everything. Anything that comes to mind, there's nothing off the table. And we're not going to be quoting you. It's not about outing anybody. We just want to have the conversation. So for 2.5 hours, we all talked, mm-hmm. and it was emotional.
It was emotional. There were situations that dealt with tolerance and intolerance. Still some shocking circumstances, but really wonderful material.
Then it took me 2 weeks to transpose that into 9 pages of bullet points of concepts and loose quotes with no names, but just loose quotes. Then that material went to Chris Heinbaugh and to Joel Farrell. And in the show that's Monday night, there are a series of dialogues in the show that are based on the material from that discussion. So there are real stories that are a part of the show.
It must be interesting. I mean, you both work with young artists. Lily, you work with very young artists at the high school. To think about the difference in perception of HIV and AIDS depending on sort of the decade in which a person came of age. Have you been surprised over the course of your teaching career to see this shift among your students?
It definitely has shifted. And if you see the statistics, truly AIDS awareness is very, very important for teenagers in the 21st century because we haven't been talking about it. You know, it wasn't as prevalent. We were right on it in the 80s and 90s when all of us were losing so many friends and wonderful artists to this horrific disease. And so it's very, very important from an educational standpoint to bring that kind of awareness to the 21st century teenager. Our kids are just inspired by participating in an event like this. And they are very honored. It's also an event that they don't have a chance to work with. For instance, Bridget Moore's, one of Bridget's pieces is going to be featuring one of the opera singers and the Dallas Symphony Strings. So it is rare that they get to experience live music.
There was one of the guys that was at the at my house for this discussion. He was 23 and grew up in a very small town that I always make fun of him about. And the next day he came up to me at the office and just said, I had no idea. Absolutely no idea. He said that night after the gathering, we call it the gathering, he just couldn't talk about it. It was overwhelming for him. And it was very interesting to hear that perspective because for those of us that lived through all of this, you know, we've been in the trenches for such a long time. And, you know, we don't have really sex education anymore. People aren't talking about safe sex. And one of the interesting comments that came out at this gathering was from one of the directors of the AIDS organizations that said one of the fastest growing groups of newly infected people are women who married very young and they're now widowed and back on the scene. Hmm. And safe sex was never a part of their lifestyle, mm-hmm. and they're getting infected.
Well, it's interesting because in the first gathering, we did a rehearsal at the Wiley, and some of the material was taken from Angels in America. Well, that show was really significant in our time, And it dawned on me as my students sat beside me that they had no earthly idea what Angels in America was. Hmm. So I spoke to them about that, and it opened up the dialogue that doesn't exist right now.
So when you are planning for an audience that includes some very young people, some people who were sort of in the prime of their young adult lives when the infection rate was at its worst, when AIDS seemed the most mysterious, and then you might have people who are of the generation above that one, how do you think about planning an evening that will affect everyone present?
Well, one of the realities about a show like this is that people who are going to attend are you're pretty much preaching to the choir. They're mm-hmm. they're informed. They're committed people in the community. They're arts lovers, but they're also committed to the cause. So my intention in all these benefits that I've done isn't to beat anyone over the head with you should do more, you should do this. We want to impart some information. We want to impart. We want to really focus on a study of the themes that we're looking at, which are hope and family and faith and loss and togetherness. But we're not here to lecture anybody. So the focus of this show, it's actually a very inspiring, really positive show and with some extraordinary singers. The soloist rehearsal on Sunday was just awe-inspiring. I mean, I was so excited when I left there. So everyone does events differently. And after I did the first one, which I thought was pretty fabulous, one of my closest friends said that he didn't feel that we delved far enough into some of the ugly realities of HIV/AIDS. And I said, you're welcome to create an event on your own. That's just not what this event was about. This was not an event to tell people you should do more. This was an event to inspire people to do more.
Have you seen the stigma change? Is that something that you talked about, the fact that people aren't talking about it today? Does that indicate that the stigma of people who do have a positive diagnosis is as bad as it ever was?
I think it's certainly still a stigma. Mm-hmm. I think it's certainly a stigma within the gay community. I think it is probably an even bigger stigma out in the the general populace, because it's just not talked about. I think the realities of HIV/AIDS have changed a lot, and that it's becoming a much more manageable disease if they're on their medications and sticking to them. But one of the scary things that came out in that gathering was a statement that there's such a young populace that says, "Oh, I'll just take a pill."
Yeah.
If it happens. And an extraordinary thing that one of the women said at this event at my house was, she said that in the locker room, that she's married and, she's established in her relationship, that the younger women around her say, well, the condoms, that's the guy's responsibility. So they take no responsibility for protection of their own health. And if they don't have a condom, they just, they'll just take the chance. They'll spin the roulette table and see what happens. It's scary.
Do you think that by having events like this, even for people who maybe don't attend, sort of hearing that this is going on is maybe starting conversations in different parts of the city where they weren't happening before?
That's the hope.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Certainly. And when Charles talks about the theme of this particular gathering, family and loss and hope, certainly there are more families, I think, that are dealing with situations, whether it's HIV/AIDS or any kind of tolerance issues, civil rights, anything, racial profiling, any of those that someone might not be tolerant, it opens the conversation. And none of us is free from that in our own personal lives and within our own personal families.
Lily Weiss is here. She is dance cluster coordinator at Booker T. Washington High School, and she will take part in a gathering 2013, which is being spearheaded by Charles Santos, who is executive director of the performing arts organization Titus and a founder of the gathering. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. You can join us at 800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses, smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about an event called A Gathering 2013, which will take place at the Winspear Opera House Monday, October 7th. Two of the organizers are with us today. Charles Santos is executive director of the performing arts organization Titus and founder of A Gathering. Lily Weiss is dance cluster coordinator at Booker T. Washington High School for the Performing and Visual Arts. If you'd like to join the conversation, ask a question, maybe share a memory or an observation of your own, please join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So if you don't mind going back a little bit in history, can you talk about being young people in the performing arts at the time when AIDS was raging? People didn't fully understand it. It seemed like something that was just destroying an entire community of people. Talk about what that felt like and how it affected you both.
Well, when I was still dancing, I remember probably about 1990, 1991, right before I made the first festival in Austin, that on one particular day, I was at four different hospitals visiting four different people. Hmm. And I remember telling my father, who, you know, I have older parents. I remember telling my father, I said, you know, it's a war mentality today for many of us. Someone will ask about, you know, somebody, and I say, oh, yeah, you know, they died. And there's not the shock factor. There wasn't a shock factor like, oh, my God, he was so young, he died. It was a war mentality. It's like, yeah, they didn't make it kind of thing. And that was an amazing revelation in the 90s, late 80s, early 90s, that we were in a war.
But with no weapon.
Yeah. And, you know, there was a great statement that that came out in the first gathering that the community, in particular the gay community, really realized that we had to change the world. We had to mobilize to make people aware of this disease, and that this was a non-discriminatory disease. It was affecting everyone. It is globally, it is more of a heterosexual disease than it is a homosexual disease. I mean, that's sort of a misconception in America. But it is a devastating disease. It's affecting our global community.
I think at that particular time, there's not an artist on this earth that didn't lose multiple friends to this disease. Certainly, it has happened on our faculty. I've had graduates, and that affects you for life.
You know, we found as we went through this whole process, a great friend of Lily's and I, of mine, died. Who actually part of that story is going to be in the gathering. Mm-hmm. And when he was being excuse me, when it was being announced that he was retiring at the university, he's a famous dancer. Somehow, none of us were with him at the house as this announcement was being made to his students, and this was probably about 4 months before he actually died. And so we all got this night. Well, this was before cell phones. It was 1994. I think it was before cell phones. And we all get these emergency pages to go to the house. And I'm the last one to arrive at the house. And, you know, Lily was there and this other friend of ours, Andrea. And Andrea's having this Hallmark moment, petting him on one side of his head. And Lily's listening. And I walk in into the middle of a very powerful conversation about that, you know, we're going on this journey together. I just didn't click in. I said, we're taking a trip. Are we going to, you know, Schlitterbahn or what? I didn't get it.
He didn't get it.
later on, it was just such a moment of such laughter about it all. You know, inside the seriousness of it all, we had to laugh about my stupidity. So we've, you know, through this discussion at my house a couple of months ago, there was a lot of levity. You know, there's a lot of really of sad tears, but there's a lot of laughter. There's, you know, you see and go through so many things in all of this.
And we talked about stigma, and certainly stigma in education. And this particular friend of ours did announce his retirement, but wasn't allowed to make it as a personal announcement. So that's why his friends all came in, so that we could actually be there to hear what was said and that the students were given the right information. But as Charles said, all of us dropped the ball, and the person we didn't call immediately to let him know how they reacted and what happened was the person that was most affected. And it was hilarious. I was the one that had to knock him over the head to say we are going on the metaphorical journey, mm-hmm. not the real road trip.
You know, and at the discussion at the house, there was a lot of stuff about family and faith and chosen family and the obstacles that faith have presented, which get a lot of attention. But a lot of discussion about the support that the faith community has really stepped forward. So many of them have stepped forward to present for people living with, you know, this disease or through the gay community. And so we address both those issues in the show. And when I say address, these are small moments. You know, these are short dialogues in between big dance numbers or big songs. But they're powerful. And we wanted to be honest. So, you know, there was no editing of what was said. We just took it.
Do you see any relationship, Charles, between the mobilization, particularly from within the gay community, to raise awareness, to demand treatment, to demand research for HIV/AIDS, and then the nascent movement that is still ongoing in many parts of the country for marriage equality and things like that?
Well, I think certainly the attention has gone to marriage equality. And, you know, I had dinner with a gentleman from Sweden this weekend. He was just going, I just don't get it. I don't know, understand why this is such a big deal. It's been legal forever in Sweden. They didn't even think about it. It's not even a topic of discussion, and it's such a big deal here. And I thought that was interesting to hear that from someone. But, yeah, I think the discussions around HIV/AIDS have faded into the background, which is why complacency has become such an issue, yeah. why infection rates are so much higher within the gay community. And it's discussed even less outside the gay community. That's why I think there's such a rate of growth amongst, minority women. There's a big impact in the African-American community, It is faded to the background. People just don't want to talk about it. It's fallen out of favor.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now and speak with Francisco in Dallas. Hi, Francisco.
Good afternoon. I want to thank you for this particular interview because I think it really celebrates that today we can use the phrase living with HIV. And I work with a lot of people who are living with HIV. And would go so far as to say that many of them are prospering with HIV and doing very well. My question is, what do you all feel can be done, especially in the arts, to offer therapy for people who live with HIV? Because it is a serious diagnosis. It does have, as you said, have that stigma. But I never really thought about what a large role the arts could play in sort of supporting these people, and especially because you think about it, we can keep the body alive, but it's a matter of keeping the soul and the psyche sort of in good health and making sure that these individuals who are on a very tremendous pill burden don't lose their humanity and lose sense of their importance in our community.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Francisco. I really appreciate it.
That's an important point. Another sort of part of my history is that I'm a 9/11 survivor. I was, I worked at the World Trade Center, and so that was where I was before I moved to Dallas. And one of the things I said, I've often gone and spoken to the kids at Booker T about my experience on 9/11, and I tell a story about, before I went to the World Trade Center, I was at Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS, and about 9/11 was a Tuesday, and about Thursday, the director, Tom Viola of Broadway Cares, called me and they just wanted to do something. So they sent me tickets to see a Broadway show, which at that time was Kiss Me, Kate. and during that time, it was and it derailed the conversation, but it was an intense week.
Yeah.
And that 2.5 hours that we took to go to this play and sort of disconnect from the burdens of the things that we were going through was enormously healing. Enormously helpful in sort of coping. And so when I've talked to the kids at Booker T, it's like you as you develop as artists, you're going to spend a lot of time as artists doing performances and donating your talent to causes. And it's not just a performance. These performances that you are going to participate in are soul nourishing for so many people. There are a lot of people that I'm sure will be in the audience that are battling battles that no one will know about, and it's no one's business. But they're going to gain something from this performance because it's such an amazingly powerful and positive show.
We hope that from the audience standpoint and certainly from the artist standpoint that people go away inspired and educated. And I think that for our students at Booker T. Washington, we always try to motivate them in some way to contribute to the community. And the arts are the perfect venue for that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Todd in Dallas. Hello, Todd.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
This is Todd Hedrick, and I'm actually friends with some of your panel today.
Hi, Todd.
Hi. I was calling actually to make a comment and to also to raise some awareness about Dallas County in particular is that Dallas County is one of the it's number one new HIV infections, highest rate in Texas, and number three in the country. And one of the things that I think has happened, and I've been involved in HIV/AIDS awareness work for many, many years, is that there's a huge HIV/AIDS fatigue, and especially with this attitude with new meds that you can live a great, you know, life and be HIV positive. But because of that, there's so much that has been lost in the last 5 to 10 years in making sure that minority communities and the younger gay community is about protecting themselves, about safe sex, and about not getting infected. And that was really one of my comments and what I just wanted to say.
Thanks for your call.
You know, we don't want to lecture people at this performance, but we want to bring attention to the disease. And so a lot of the facts that Todd is talking about will be stated. We have these readings that happen in between many of the pieces, and a lot of those that kind of information is shared. But I think the biggest thing is that you come to this event and it starts discussions. It starts a dialogue from the you know, on stage and off stage. It just starts, I guess I should say not on stage and off stage, but on stage and in the audience. It starts dialogues. And, you know, from the stage perspective, I love that we're raising important money and I love the show, but I really love the collaborative effort that this particular project creates. All the pieces that were created for the first gathering all went on. And one of the pieces that Bruce Wood did became a full evening piece. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just the cultural landscape is changing so much in Dallas, and we have to find ways to work together. And projects like this just really help that happen. And I'm just happy that it's for such an important cause.
And if certainly any audience member, we had lots of Arts Magnet Advisory Board members at the first event who wanted Charles to take this whole event on tour. And what I said to them is, I don't think that was the true purpose, is to make this an event that went on tour.
That's been an ongoing question about taking this on tour.
But if you watched backstage, all the artists watching each other and really getting this sense of community, you saw what could actually happen in the future of the arts in Dallas. I just think it's amazing. And I do think, to Todd's point, that whatever we can do to make people aware all year long, not just December 1st and not just when these events happen, it's important. The dialogues have to happen. And we hope that people will come and they will bring friends and family and begin the dialogue.
I don't mean to sound flip here, because I actually do think it's extraordinary what you're describing about the sort of magical temporary dissolution of all egos among mm-hmm. people who might ordinarily be in direct competition with one another for roles, for stage time. It sounds like none of that happened last time and none of that is happening this
time.
None
of it has happened either time. And I was prepared. You know, you never know.
And I was prepared from an education standpoint to work with high school kids. Sometimes it doesn't seem like our students are worthy to work with these kinds of musicians. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't about that. It wasn't about talent or resume or anything. It was about the cause.
Yeah, and the DSO is the organization came in this year that didn't get to participate the first time, and they've just been so generous. They're providing the strings and they're singers. At one point, you know, there was a miscommunication that we would have space for all of the chorus, which was 90 people. Well, there's already 225 people on stage. So there was no way to physically accommodate it. So they made the adjustments and are sending soloists. And, you know, it's just nice to see them creating this work. And they're going to be playing and singing for a piece that the Arts Magnet is choreographing. And the musicians are playing for a piece that Texas Ballet Theater is doing. And the singer who's coming in from the Dallas Opera, Mary Dunleavy, who's going to be doing Carmen, we've not met yet. But she's been rehearsing wherever she lives. And we spoke on the phone yesterday. We'll meet on Sunday and we'll work it all out. And it's just been, you know, it's been great. Everyone sort of just will make it work.
As a director, that has to you have to just go into this with a really zen attitude, right? Because as much as you trust everyone who's off rehearsing on their own, you're saying goodbye to a lot of control that you'd ordinarily,
I would imagine,
demand for yourself.
So I run around and see all the pieces, and I talk a lot with the music director. Last week, I was, you know, losing it a little bit because I had three giant grants that I had to do, my actual real job I had to do. And when I feel myself getting stressed out, I remind myself this is an absolutely wasted emotion. Mm-hmm. Freaking out gets you nowhere but exhausts you. So just pick a task and do it. And so that's generally what I do. And you know, and I really try not to procrastinate. Just get it done. I'd rather stay up till 3 a.m. and get it done than not have a backup the next day. So we just keep forging forward. And the collaborators have been so great. Chris Heinbaugh is so fantastic with the center, and the AT&T Performing Arts Center has been so generous in allowing us to use this magnificent opera house and awesome rehearsal spaces and parking. And it's just been great.
We're going to take a quick break here and also say goodbye to Lily Weiss of Booker T. Washington High School. She's got a family obligation. So, Lily, thank you so much
thank
for being
you
with us. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Titus Executive Director Charles Santos, who is a founder of A Gathering and A Gathering 2013, which takes place at the Winspear Opera House this coming Monday, October 7th. You can join our conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses, smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking right now with Charles Santos, who is executive director of the performing arts organization Titus and a founder of A Gathering. A Gathering 2013 will take place this coming Monday, October 7th at the Winspear Opera House. You can find information online. And if you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372. Charles, tell us a little bit about the show itself and what we can expect if we're able to make it out on Monday.
So the show's great. It's super, super fun. It runs the gambit from Vivaldi to a Joan Osborne song to I Got the Music in Me to a remake of a Justin Bieber Will I Am song called #ThatPower.
Wait, literally something for everyone.
Literally something for everyone. So it is not a morose, you know, show. It's not a fully classical show. There is there are all kinds of music throughout this whole thing.
And it sounds like family friendly?
Absolutely family friendly. Yeah. You know, it starts with a portion of a sort of a redo of the Beatles' Imagine, because it sort of in putting this show together, the way this sort of happened after we did the first one, I didn't really commit to doing another one. And then as I watched trash TV that I love to watch, like The Voice or, you know, any sort of dance competition kind of thing, or not all of them, but or I go to a performance, I hear a piece of music and I tag it on my phone, mm-hmm. or I'll write a note on my phone this would be interesting to use. And then I had about 40 pieces of music all of a sudden, and I thought, okay, it's time to put something together. And Imagine sort of really spoke to me about imagine if, imagine how, imagine what, if, you know, things were different. And so that sort of started the conversation of the themes for the show. So, you know, it's a little bit of everything. I mean, there's scenes from Philadelphia. There's this beautiful song that Gary Floyd sings called There's a World from a play that's really about bipolarism. But and one of the things I kept telling my collaborators is as we look for material, if you take it out of context, it has a new meaning. There is a world is about, you know, bipolarism, that there's a world where there's none of this pain. Hmm. But when you put it into this an AIDS benefit, it has a whole a similar meaning, but it's relevant to the issue at hand. So there's a lot in here. It's a, you know, I'm really, every time I run the show, I'm really happy with it. It's just so positive.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Rebecca on the line in Dallas. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. Well, the timing of my call almost is going to sound planned, because I was actually calling to say that I saw the show last year, and I just wanted to sort of provide a testimonial that if anybody thinks that this could in any way be sort of a downer or kind of depressing, that it is so not. It was stunning in the extreme. It was one of the most inspiring and beautiful shows I've ever seen, and I've seen a lot of theater and dance. So I was really just calling to, you know, provide a voice of an audience member from last year.
Thanks, Rebecca. You're hired.
New on the PR and marketing team. And we should stress this is a fundraiser, right? Last
Absolutely.
Time you took in something like $40,000.
Right. And then we distributed to, we just selected four aid service organizations, and we've stuck with the same four. The same format. So I've gotten underwriters to underwrite all the costs of producing something like this, the things that we can't get donated, you know, some of the union requirements around stagehands and labor, those things that we have to pay for, things for printing, whatnot, things like that. We've gotten all of that underwritten. And so everything will go to the four AIDS organizations. We didn't do performance comps. I bought my tickets last week. Ben Stevenson bought his. We've all but purchased our tickets so that we can raise as much money as possible.
And the ticket prices range?
They range from $19 to $60. Mm-hmm. So it's not, you know, it's not outrageous.
Mm-hmm. And a Monday night makes sense because that's maybe the only night that some of your performers have off.
That's right. It's the dark night. So for those that are wondering why we would pick such a bizarre night, it's the dark night for most theater. So it was the only way to get all the actors that we needed to participate in this.
Can you talk a little bit about the energy backstage and what that feels like?
So the energy backstage, like Lily said earlier, it's so exciting. And, you know, generally I'm not a nervous person. I've been in the arts forever. But I was more nervous than I have ever been for anything I've ever been involved with that first year. I could not sit in the audience. I had to sit backstage. And I just felt calmer sitting on a stool with a script and, you know, and watching all the action happening. There's we have wranglers that are volunteers that run out to grab the readers who do these readings throughout the show, who we don't want them to have to miss the show. So they sit in the theater, and we've mapped out a whole grid of who's sitting on what side of the theater and when they have to be brought backstage. And so all this stuff happens. And as Lily said, it's very exciting to watch the performers backstage watching all the other pieces. So there's not sort of a, I'm done, I'm going to change my clothes and leave. Everyone stays in the wings. The only people really in the wings are the dancers for the most part. But everyone hangs out and everybody watches every piece. So it's exciting to watch that kind of energy happen backstage.
Are there people who you mentioned that, you know, when you had people at your home, you said that none of this is sort of going to be attached to you personally. Mm-hmm. Were there people who said, I want to be represented directly in this way?
My colleagues, my collaborators had felt that we should identify people. But I think my role, in producing this thing is at some point I become the no person. Mm-hmm. And I learned from a great friend a long time ago, everybody will always comment about how you can do a project better and you should do this and you should do that. And a lot of it's good information. A lot of it isn't. And you sort of just have to take it all and stay true to your vision is, you know, the common theme for anyone who produces events or you have to stay true to your vision. And I just didn't want it to be. I wanted it to be personal but not specific. So I just said, yeah, we're not doing that.
I have to imagine that there were relationships formed last time that have lasted and maybe led to different collaborations that are completely unrelated to the project itself.
Well, Bruce was the best example. Truly one of the great choreographers, certainly in our area. And Bruce had created this trio to a Joni Mitchell song called Blue for the show. And in the show, we had this fantastic singer, Gary Floyd, who's music director for us. And Bruce and Gary meet, and you know, he sings beautifully, and this beautiful dance happens, and they meet, and they start collaborating. Bruce builds this piece called My Brother's Keeper, which is a full evening-length piece. It's a men's piece. And it's about relationships between men, brothers, fathers, lovers, cousins. You know, it's just relationships. And Jack Alder was in it as well, who's a marvelous actor, and he runs Theater 3. And that piece, you know, he may have had the seeds in his head about creating a piece like this, but it came from the gathering because he'd done this piece. He met Gary. So the synergy happened in those collaborations, and this piece was born. And it's spectacular work that he created, and I was so happy to see that happen. We had a girl from Booker T who was a sophomore. Her name is Rachel Dupard, and she's a freshman this year in Point Park. And I heard her singing at Booker T, singing We Shall Overcome, a cappella and deconstructed. Actually, it was a 9/11 event. And it was so fabulous. I met her. I went up to her and said, you know, I'm Charles Santos, and I'm doing this project. You have to be in it. And so I invited her to sing that walking down the aisle, and it was magical. And then she got to sing with everything else. And her mother came up to me this past year when ATT was announcing the Broadway series and said that that event changed her daughter's life, that it set her on a new path. It focused her interest as an artist. She got gigs from that event. Mm. She went on and sang with a Troquet Chorale. She went and did some other gigs. And now she's on a scholarship at Point Park. And she's a fantastic artist. She'll be, you know. So I love seeing all that happen with projects like this.
Do you think that the sort of broader Dallas community outside the gay community, outside the arts community, needs sort of more of a wake-up call than they may realize?
Sure, absolutely. You know, I mean, I don't want to preach, but yeah, absolutely. And I think that people who might stay away from this event because it's an AIDS benefit are missing one of the great nights of theater that happened in Dallas. It was to see all these artists coming together, sharing their talents, and in an exciting show. If you're not there, you're missing out because it only happens once. We're not doing a run. So it'll be one night. To miss it would be a crime.
You know, there's something really remarkable about that alone, a one-night-only event these days, because everything is sort of made to be repurposed later on, right?
Right.
And so there's something more special about it.
It is. It's also very frustrating. You know, you work your tail off, and then all of a sudden it's over. At 10:30, it's like, what do? I'm done. But yeah, it's very exciting. It makes a very unique event. This is the year that I've had to tell a lot of people no. I got a lot of emails from performers who wanted to be involved. And at some point, you just have to go, this is the cast.
Yeah.
We cannot add any more to this. It has to be, succinct.
You can't do a 9-hour show.
Can't do a 9-hour show.
Mm-hmm. So how did you make those tough calls?
It's just, you know, like I've told people about the Titus series and the dance that we bring into town, everyone is subjected to my taste. So all the music that's in the show are pieces that I selected. And then I work with my collaborators, whether it's Ben Stevenson or Bruce or Bridget or Chris or Joel or whomever, and say, here are the pieces that are in this show. What can you do with them? And that's just the way it is. So it is at some point you have all projects, whether it's an evening of Texas Ballet Theater or an opera or a Titus series or whatever, Dallas Theater Center, they're all subject to the tastes of the artistic director. And in that case, in this case, it's me.
It's so interesting, I think, for people about the age that you and I are to live in a time where an HIV diagnosis is not a death sentence. And that's also something that it seems like the community has had to get a handle on over the years, that suddenly there's a possibility for a full and very often pretty healthy life.
Absolutely. And it is a big shift. I think one of the things that a lot of people who survived the 80s and 90s and are doing well with medications had to realize this, oh, my God, I've got a plan for retirement.
Yeah.
And that's a real reality, you know. It is still a deadly disease. It will still kill you if you are not on a healthy regimen with, you know, with your doctors and medications. But it is not the death sentence that it used to be. But it is still a deadly disease.
Is there a feeling within the gay community that older folks really need to mentor younger people and say, please be aware of the risks of this?
You know, I think that is probably an attitude for a lot of us that are, I would certainly fall into the older category. But I, again, because we're not talking about this disease, excuse me, there is a complacency. And on the, you know, and I don't mean to be so finger pointing, but there is a complacency to the younger population, whether it is gay or straight, mm-hmm. that they're invincible. I mean, that is a general feeling I think that the youth have in just across the world, that they're invincible. And this idea that they can, oh, I'll just take a pill. You know, I'll take a pill. What they're missing is for the rest of my life.
Yeah, by a really – my understanding is, I mean, the regimen is pretty demanding. You have to follow it pretty carefully. You have to do a lot of follow-up visits. It's not like you take a pill and you're cured.
Right. This is for the rest of my life is the missing part of that sentence. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think, you know – so I hope events like this spur new discussions, spur new participation, spur new collaboration because it's important.
So tickets are still available for
Monday night? Absolutely. Tickets are still available. They can get them through attpac.org. They can call the ATPAC box office. It really shouldn't be missed.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine that the best thing to do is to reserve those ahead of time.
Absolutely.
Okay. This is in the Opera House, so there's lots of space.
Yeah, it's a big hall. It's very beautiful. For those who don't have the phone number, the box office is 214-880-0202. But it is in the Opera House. And that's also one of the exciting things for someone like me to provide some of these artists that are participating who have never been in this theater. They're going to get to sing, you know, on what was just been called by Opera America the greatest opera hall in the world. So it's exciting for me to be able to provide that opportunity with my partners at the center.
Well, I certainly wish you all the best. It sounds fantastic.
Thanks.
And very exciting. And I hope that you get a little bit of maybe an hour or two of sleep between now and and Monday. Charles Santos is executive director of the performing arts organization Titus and a founder of A Gathering. A Gathering 2013 takes place at the Winspear Opera House next Monday, October 7th. Charles, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Christine McConnell does our podcast. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.